In the last few weeks in March, we've been exploring what we mean by resilience, what it would mean if we were working on that almost as a goal, if we worked on increasing our capacity to be resilient. What kind of practices would be helpful in learning how to do that, to move in that direction? Resilience has to do with having something come back to its original shape, something that can withstand whatever the external forces are, whatever those things are in our lives that either help us to celebrate or make us sorrowful. That's resilience. Last Sunday, Jim talked about the need for practices, things like giving up the thought that things are meant to be easy or that they're supposed to go well, keeping a little flame of hope alive and doing it in community. I'm pretty sure that if we did those things, we would be practicing to be more resilient. They'd keep us on track. They'd link us to community standards that would help us to do that better. If we let it in, we can find inspiration for that kind of practice almost anywhere. In this congregation, I've watched a man who had one of his knees replaced with one of those mechanical things, you know, that's supposed to bend and straighten out. He struggled for a while to get up. The expression on his face told me that he was not expecting this to take as long as it has. We've known people who had that surgery on Monday, and by Friday, they felt fine. But that's not the way it went for this particular person. He was still having trouble by the middle of March getting to his feet. So I've been really pleased to watch him get up and come to the front of this sanctuary without his cane. That takes a lot. That's really quiet resilience for you. It's no big deal. Nobody gets applause for it. It's just a man walking up here in front to share something of his life, but he shares something about his character in the process. I find things everywhere that nudge me in the direction of learning to be more resilient. Sometimes I watch a channel called Animal Planet. I've been watching people who live so far in the north of Alaska that their soil is hard all the time. They've got permafrost. Summer lasts for about 4 months up there. They have 8 months to get through with what food they've been able to put aside and cope for themselves. And one of the women who lives in that little community, which is called Tanana, likes to try to raise bees in Alaska. And you wouldn't really think that it was all that easy to do. She likes the honey that they produce because it gives her something to sweeten her tea, and it's easy to think about those bees in the summer, but in the winter, it's really something else. I watched her take a bale of straw apart and use it to insulate the hive, and then she put a burlap sack over the whole thing and bound it up with a cord because in that way, the bees would have the warmth that they produce with their own bodies. Bees, as it turns out, which I've learned from this book called A Monk in the Beehive, bees live without taking resources. They make exactly enough as they eat and drink and need to oxidize and give themselves energy. They don't produce, nothing comes out, nothing goes away because they use every single resource that they produce. They create a flow of cooling air with their wings. If they need a little coolness, if they need warmth, they huddle together in a bundle. The female workers do all this. The drones kind of hang out in case they're needed. Wait for the queen to be making new eggs. They really don't have a concept of the kind of problems that we think are absolutely overwhelming to us. They don't know that human beings treat each other rather brutally a lot. They never heard of global warming. They wouldn't know what the concept was. They do know that if the temperature in the hive gets too high, they may need to sacrifice their own lives for the good of the community. And I think of them in terms of resilience. This book called A Monk in the Beehive, I picked it up because I read a story in the local newspaper, which I read on Thursdays, and one of the community sections told me about a Buddhist monk. Her name is Sky Ann Taylor, and she is a monk and also a beekeeper. And she reminded me of my own first career, which was in human genetics. I started in genetics so far back that in those days people thought we had 48 chromosomes. We don't. We have 46. But they had no idea how to culture the cells and spread those chromosomes out and count them and see what kinds of contributions they made to our lives. Back then, the belief system that I was most familiar with came from the Bible, and it told me that we, as humans, were supposed to have dominion over the earth. We were supposed to be in charge of all the life forms that are supported by this earth. And there were a very small number of people who thought, we ought to question that. We're not quite sure that's the right thing to do. Nowadays, we know that we need to think hard about our capacity, not only for human life, but for life itself. That we can do things as human beings that may destroy the capacity of this planet to support life. And that's what we're worried about. Not that the planet's going to go away, that's silly. Of course the planet's not going to go away, but its capacity to support life really could. This is the kind of complex issue that I come to this congregation to talk about because it's one of the very few places where I can do that. We're interested in these sorts of things. We really are physicists and geneticists and chemists and artists and poets, roller skaters and singers and people who have all kinds of ways of looking after this great earth on which we live. The people who write poetry, the people who think, I wonder if physics can give us an answer instead of a problem. And that's why I went to a bookstore to find a copy of this book, A Monk in the Beehive. It's not very big and it's not very expensive, but it's where I heard for the first time about this woman's idea that we can do something besides just depend completely on our senses of touch and smell, of hearing and sight, feeling. We can add five more. And the five that she wants to add are generosity and ethical conduct, patience, diligence, and meditation. And I think if we learned those five things as senses along with these others that we're accustomed to thinking about, that's what is going to help us. If we really were to begin a process of dialogue like that, where we really talked about the things we're so afraid of, about the things that could turn life in a direction that we weren't counting on when we started manipulating and developing cheese whiz and stuff like that.
Cheese whiz.
And you know that we don't agree on all these things. We who sit in this room this morning, we are not in agreement. There are people in this room who think science can solve these problems and will. They really seriously mean this. There are people who are afraid of that and wonder if this is where we got by using these things, where are we going to get to next? We're all in here together and we have to figure this out.
There are people in this room who love Cheese Whiz.
It's true.
See, I knew.
It really is true. I found out on NPR this morning that Cheese Whiz was developed because people wanted to make it easy to make Welsh rarebit. It's a cheese fondue, which is really delicious, and Cheese Whiz is supposed to taste just like that. Well, one of the things that being a Unitarian Universalist does for me is that it gives me these practices, like respect for the interdependent web of which we are all a part. I know that I was given a mind, and my faith community encourages me to use it and to find out what kind of practice it is that's going to help us in these great quandaries and dilemmas. So this little book, this woman who wrote about the great bee, who uses the sacred geometry of the hexagon instead of the carbon circle of fossil fuels, she doesn't assign blame for what's happened in terms of climate change or inequalities or destructive social practices that make some people feel better than others. She doesn't belabor the idea of meditation. She's not really keen on sit this way, breathe this way, hold your hands like this. She just says we gotta have something that will turn us to hope instead of to despair. She invites us to live with one another with consideration, and she reminded me that that word, consideration, has a Latin root, and the con part means with. And the sidera, that's for stars. And she reminds us that there was a time when we humans could look up at night and see them. We've almost lost that. There are places on this earth today where we can't see the stars at night. She says that if we live with consideration, we'll get back to the point where we can see the stars again and consider the price we're paying for the fact that nowadays we can see the lights that we produce artificially from space. What we can't do anymore is see space. And she says we need to talk about that and figure out what we are going to do to make that better. She brings this kind of sacred geometry, the kind that bees use, into the reach of every human being. Bees live without waste. They take in, they let go exactly as much as they need. And if they can do it, I think we probably can too. We just need to learn more about how. Should the faith community to which we belong not help us to turn our attention to these five senses? Can we not hope that generosity, ethical conduct, patience, diligence, and meditation can help us to use our humanity for good instead of for ill? The principles, the purposes, the sources of our faith community of Unitarian Universalism provide some really good ways of moving in that direction. The mission of this congregation and the vision that I hope we have can help us to do that too. The stakes have never been higher. Our need to do these things has never been stronger. So what I hope is that we add those five senses to the ones that we've learned about since we were so small that we don't even remember how we first learned how to hear or see or touch or feel or smell. I want to add those five that she listed to the ones we already know about so that on this beautiful planet, the one that's coming into spring now as we look out, these trees that are learning to bloom again, I want to create here a house of hope for this beloved community and for the community in which we live. And I hope, I really do hope, that we all want to do that and that we can make it so.